you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have David Wimhoff back on the show. Of course, David is an attorney practicing in South Bend, Indiana. He's also an author. He has written John Courtney Murray, Time, Life, and the American Proposition, How the CIA's Doctrinal Warfare Program Changed the Catholic Church. I've read the book, and it really is a fascinating book, an essential read, a very heavy book, and it takes on a very important topic. Regarding the United States, Catholic Church, church and state relations, the relations between church and state, what exactly America is and how it relates to the Catholic Church. Of course, David, you have a website, right? The American Proposition?
I do, theamericanproposition.com.
And for those who haven't read the book, they can go to that website, sort of get a sample of kind of what you cover. You've posted some very well-written articles covering some of the topics in the book, and so I do recommend you go to that website and read some of the postings there, and you'll get sort of a sample of what you'll find in that book. Was that the idea behind that website?
Well, I think it is, Tim. In doing the book, I had to get an understanding of a number of things, and one of those things was just why is the church and state and religious liberty doctrines so important, and why were they so important in the middle of the last century? And also, that necessarily implicates just what is the nature of this society known as America and the political entity known as the United States. So the book really had a lot of different themes and ideas in it. I know, at least for me, it helped me to understand writing it, researching it. It helped me to understand a lot, in particular about the nature of America, the importance of certain principles in societal organization, and just what happened to the Catholic Church in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in the book, You present evidence of a collaboration between the three major pillars of American society and spreading this global ideology, Americanism, spreading it throughout the world. And you start with, or you start talking about President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Four Freedoms, his speech in January 1941. Of course, the context of this is the Second World War. At that point, we're about 11 months away from America's entry, although, as we know, the Roosevelt administration was determined to get us into that war, and they ultimately succeeded. So here we have the context of the Second World War, then the Cold War. And in this process, the United States, particularly after the Second World War, that the doctrinal warfare that was declared after the Second World War and the early parts of the Cold War was to utilize religions, mobilize it against the our erstwhile allies, the Soviet Union, in the Cold War. And the Catholic Church was a specific target in that, correct?
All the churches were, but the Catholic Church in particular, because the Catholic Church is international. I'll tell you by way of anecdote, I did a lot of this research in the Dwight D. Eisenhower Presidential Library in Kansas, and directly across the street is a Catholic church. So, you know, the Catholics have got outposts at a lot of places around the world, almost in every town. So, and it's an international hierarchical organization. So it was a very, very important organization for the Americans to get on board with their ideology and to spread it around the globe. And my book details how the American effort was undertaken and was just phenomenally successful in getting the Catholic Church leadership to accept the ideology of social organization, which underlies America and all liberal countries, capital L, how it got the Catholic Church leadership to accept that as good in practice as well as in theory.
And you cite certain doctrines, or these secular doctrines that have been sort of canonized, effectively canonized in ideas. One thing is, well, I guess these documents are the Declaration of Independence and the United States Constitution, and the idea that the ideas set forth in these things, the ideologies themselves, were good in and of themselves, and perhaps ideal, and therefore they were ready for export, so to speak. Right?
I think that the principles set forth in those documents are being shipped around the world, and they were shipped around the world through the Catholic Church. They still are. But by 1941, the Americans had been on a march for a long time. And by 1941, the Americans had the opportunity with the Second World War. They had the means, which was psychological warfare, and they had the motive. And the motive was to push these ideas around the world to different societies, and these societies would then reorganize themselves to be like America and become friendly to America.
And this is Americanism. Now, how does this, let's say for American Catholics, tens of millions of Americans were Catholics at this time, particularly Irish and German and Polish, and how does this ideology or outlook, worldview, conflict with, say, how with church doctrine? How them being good Catholics, can you know how does it being patriotic Americans contradict Catholic doctrine or in these teachings?
Well, the Catholic Church leadership nowadays would say it doesn't, but in the course of the book, I discuss the dispute, the fight, if you will, on theological and ideological and philosophical grounds. Father Connell led what we might consider the Catholic side, at least in terms of my book, and he presented the Catholic doctrine, which is that every society is required to follow the divine positive law of Jesus Christ. And that was really the essence of the struggle. What is supposed to be the basis of the public policy and also of the laws of a country, of a society. And it's supposed to be the divine positive law of Jesus Christ, as Father Connell explained, is Catholic doctrine. John Courtney Murray said, no, all you really have to do is follow the natural law. And the natural law is an equivocal concept, an ambivalent or ambiguous concept at best. It is one that Henry Luce used, and a lot of the Americans used. because it's open to interpretation. In many ways, that's really the fundamental issue, because the divine positive law carries with it a whole set of requirements that every society has got to follow. The natural law is something which is not at odds with the divine positive law, but it is not the completion of the requirements that a society is supposed to follow.
Mm-hmm. And so with this American ideology, you cite what this really creates a situation under the guise of liberty and individual rights, a situation where private powerful parties or interest can control society through the various, culture institutions they control. That'd be the press, media, entertainment, and also the government. And through this process, society becomes infused with, oriented towards materialism, material progress, prosperity. And this sort of erodes the traditions or maybe the corporate relationships that they have, particularly through a parish or a church, and atomizes society, and then makes that society, say, open towards globalism, marketing, expansion of a sort of economic order, global economic order, which you cite was championed by people like Henry Luce and, of course, C.D. Jackson, like as such, correct? Is that a fair representation?
Well, I think it's fairly accurate. America, the society, is based on certain principles, and the United States, as the political entity, protects, defends, encourages, and spreads these principles. And these principles have to do with organizing the society. We all live in accordance with it, and we really think nothing of it. It's kind of like the air we breathe. An essential part of those principles, one of the most fundamental, is the relationship of the society towards a deity. It could be any deity. Pick one. It could be Amun-Ra. It could be Christ. It could be Buddha. Pick somebody. That necessarily implicates the idea of how is a civil society supposed to deal with religion. All through history until the time of the American Revolution, there was always a state church, there was always a state religion. Now, people weren't necessarily forced to convert, but there was a state church that got the protection of the government, and that in turn supported the government and also served in many cases as a check on the power of the government and power of private individuals in that society. When the American Revolution came along, one of the big things that happened was the privatization of religion. We hear a lot about privatization of government functions, but here we have the privatization of religion, and the government, the civil authorities, took no position whatsoever on religion, and so you have the First Amendment, which is the non-establishment clause, which says there would be no established church or religion. And then you also have freedom to practice your beliefs. So, yes, it was a very individualistic individualistic theme of the American foundation. It remains so to this day. There is no established church. There's no established religion. There is, as a result, people having the ability to join or not join any religion they want. So several things happen when that happens. When you have no established religion, when you have no established church, you do have a fracturing of society. That's true to a degree. You also, too, have a lessening of tension in society, which means that you're not going to have some unelected church leader tell you, you know, you're an adulterer or you are a cheater in business, or you've done things against the moral code. Thomas Jefferson was slapped down in the 1700s by the Church of Virginia, and he never forgot that. Because there was an established state church in Virginia at the time. So when you remove the church, any church, from a position of recognition in law as the state church, a powerful check is removed from the government and over private individuals. And the churches, coupled with the idea of this religious liberty, you know, believing whatever you want to believe, the churches really lose power over the culture and over their own people. So you get a rise in fanaticism, you get all sorts of crazy ideas in the churches, and you get this constant struggle between the churches, you know, to try to stay relevant, to keep members, and so on and so forth. That having been said, the churches have completely bought into the American system of organization. The Catholic Church has definitely embraced it. Pope Francis, on May 9th of 2016, gave an interview to a French newspaper, and he said the confessional state, which is the term for the how society is supposed to be organized with the Catholic Church recognized, and the policies being based on the Catholic faith, he says the confessional state just doesn't work. So there you got it. That is evidence that the American system of social organization is now preeminent in the world.
Mm-hmm. And this was, well, one thing, the fraction you talk about, another term could be pluralism. And the pluralism is kind of what the American, you know, system was based on. But I think, as you write in the book, as the founding fathers themselves designed this system, so religion would become, well, the various religions would become fractured, and therefore enough that they would promote that the standards of behavior that were conducive to business and commerce.
Well, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. The churches lose power to influence the culture. And so what liberalism does, and America is a liberal country and it was based on liberalism, and it still is, what liberalism does, and that's a capital L, what liberalism does is it effectively serves to concentrate wealth, because it gives ultimate power to these powerful private interests. And these are the people who have the will, the ability, and the money to influence public opinion or to influence key people to see things their way.
Mm-hmm. And what was it about the hierarchy of the American Catholic Church that made them so vulnerable to the allure or seduction of Americanism? Is it geography? Is it just, you know, contingencies? What's going on there?
Well, it goes way back. Catholics in America, for the most part, the Catholic hierarchy in America, has been very open to America as the ideal of social organization. And it goes really all the way back to John Carroll, because he supported the American Revolution and the principles that led people to go out and fight. I think that what was a driving force was that by accepting these principles, the Catholic prelates could sit at the table with the big guys, and they could have what might be called relevance in society. They would get along with everybody, and they could materially prosper. That's really how the system works over here. If you in America, you know, want to be contentious, and if you want to be uncooperative, very good chance, you know, you are not going to prosper. You're going to be marginalized, and you're not going to do well all the way around.
Yeah, I think you have a quote here. Is the only principle I found on your blog. The only principle here, Greg, is this leads to something more profound in its recognition. America's foundation principle is that there are no principles. Practicality is the principle. Whatever works is the principle. And that is that American pragmatism, which kind of grows out of, I guess, British empiricism, I guess. The idea is that the system does produce a lot of wealth, a lot of dynamism. So it's very attractive. And so you can have the church itself can materially prosper in America.
Yes.
And indeed it did. But that was the source of its spiritual corruption.
America is or can be all things to all people. It has the enormous ability, and this is part of its resiliency, it has the enormous ability to absorb all sorts of people and to let these people prosper. If you want to, let me use an example. It's January. So let me use. Okay, so if you're against abortion, well, don't have one. Okay, but the reality is that if you want an abortion, you can have one. So you can allow people who want abortion to live in that society alongside the people who don't want to have abortions. If you want a gay marriage, you can have a gay marriage. If you don't want one, well, don't have one. So you can have your little society with your little cause or causes. And you can get along just as well with everyone who holds something diametrically opposed to you. And you all agree to take your disagreements, you know, to the public space and demonstrate or vote, as the case may be. And you agree on the outcome or submit to the courts or do it, you know, and let your issues be contested and resolved peacefully. That's another aspect of the resiliency of America that I'm going to prepare something for my blog or my website on. And that is that in America, everybody thinks that we can resolve our differences. And if we can't resolve them, we can at least, you know, work together and keep it going. And that works. That does work. That has worked very well. Widely divergent people for a very long period of time. It's going to continue to work that way. There's not going to be any change on the horizon because the principles make sure that this pluralism can flourish. It's an ingenious system. It's a brilliant system. Part of the essence of this of America and Americanism is that, well, you know, we can sit around and we can talk it out, and the truth will come out, and we'll just all know how to do the right thing from that point on. Well, that's a part of Americanism that the church also absorbed. And so when you have the Vatican II Council opening in October 1962, you have Pope St. John the 23rd saying, you know, we're going to use the medicine of mercy from here on out. We're going to, you know, just kind of talk to people and the truth will out. Well, and people will see the truth and they're just going to act on the truth. Well, that's an American, America gave that idea a real boost. The church accepted it in a big way during the Cold War, after World War II, and we're living with that, you know, pretty much to this day. But America does allow pluralism. It does allow a lot of different people to work together and be successful, and to have good lives. And you're free to do what you want, whatever you want to do. You, if you want to be a writer, you can be a writer. If you want to be a lawyer, you can be a lawyer. If you want to make a lot of money, you can make a lot of money. You want to be an actor, you can be an actor. If you want to sit at home and watch TV, you can do that too. And there is nobody, not even the churches, who really have the power over anybody. It is up to the individual. And these ideas are being spread around the world. These ideas have become, I think, the modus vivendi of Europe in large measure since World War II. And everybody wants these ideas because it allows everybody to prosper peacefully.
And these ideas were intentionally injected into Europe, particularly Western Europe, after the Second World War. A particular target was West Germany, injecting some of these ideas. I know the State Department sent back the cultural Marxists to reform German thinking, at least to the extent that they think that the conquering Allies thought German thinking needed to be reformed. You mentioned Vatican II, and a lot of these this is occurring in that critical period, 1959. Pope John the 23rd calls for ecumenical council. It convenes 1962 and closes 1965. This also coincides with some very important events here in the United States regarding Catholicism, because this roughly coincides with the Land O'Lakes Conference and the alienation of Notre Dame from the church, and the putting under lay, it was Hesburgh when he put it under lay authority, the controversies at the Catholic University with Father Curran and these things. So there's a lot of turmoil that's bred out of Vatican II, at least the interpretation of Vatican II. And in your book, you cover a lot of Vatican II, how it was Vatican II was sort of utilized by these agents, John Courtney Murray, and also who was the B'nai B'rith agent. What's his name? You know, the guy with Keys to the Split. Malachi Martin. Malachi Martin. Yeah. Go ahead.
I think I just briefly touched on Malachi Martin. But, mm-hmm. but what you had is you really had, with Vatican II, you had kind of an American morality play. You know, guys in white hats and guys in black hats. And everybody understood that because the Westerns were big in America at the time. You know, and the guys in the black hats were Ottaviani. The guys in the white hats were Murray. And I detail in my book the very language that the American press used, you know, to characterize the fights, to characterize these individuals who were good or bad. And it was viewed as a struggle for freedom and a struggle for progress. And, you know, this is 1962 to 1965. The bloodiest war in history had just been fought, you know, 17 to 20 years earlier. And America emerged the winner. Everybody else lost, but America won. And America was viewed as the ideal society. We had the military might. The United States had the military might, had the economic might. It had the media. It had the technology. And everybody saw that as a successful way to organize society and come out of the darkness into the light. And everybody got along.
Mm-hmm. And this is also the time, of course, you've written how the importance of Vatican II is not so much the letter of Vatican II, it was the spirit of Vatican II, which I think was coined by Time magazine, and how it was interpreted. And Henry Luce sent his agents to make sure that the interpretation of Vatican II, particularly the United States, would be far different than the letter, and that would kind of expose the church to that corruption. I'm getting feedback now. One testing. Okay, now I'm better. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sure, no, not a problem. I heard a little bit myself.
Yeah.
But the spirit of Vatican II, you're right. That, as far as I can tell, first appeared in the pages of Time magazine. My theory is it was coined by Michael Novak. Michael Novak was covering the Vatican II Council because Robert Blair Kaiser couldn't for various reasons. But the spirit of Vatican II is really, in my view, Americanism. And Americanism is the idea that America knows better than the church, and it teaches the church. And America is based on liberalism, which is based on the Enlightenment, which says man can do it all by himself. It means all you need is the natural law. We all kind of know what the right thing is. And what you had was Time magazine, and you had the American media, and then you had the echo chamber in the Catholic press, for the most part, repeating the morality play that, you know, America's good, we have the white hats. Ottaviani and the Catholic Church, especially the Curia, the Catholic leadership, rather, especially the Curia, they're bad, they're aggressive, they wear the dark hats. And we need to spread freedom to the church, and things will be so much better if that happens. And the laity need to get involved, and the laity need to run the show like in America. And so, you know, what happened is you had this struggle, and the Americans won, and the church is now a lot like, you know, America. You have the laity having a lot of say in what happens. They are involved in the liturgy. They have their causes the church falls in line with, and you hear absolutely no criticism from the pulpit of any of the principles of liberalism anymore.
There's a wonderful quote I think I found in your book. I wrote it down here, Falcone, and he said, "The leadership of the Roman Catholic Church belong to the United States in the same way that the political leadership of the Western world was in its hands." So,
I think the leadership of the church gradually came over to see or to be allied with the United States and with America. Yeah.
Uh-huh. One way you can look at this also is how were some of the people within the church, but in the United States, that might have opposed this. And I don't know, have you done a lot of thought, maybe, you know, Father Coughlin, might have been an opponent, and he was opposed by the hierarchy. You know, this preacher in the 30s, this Catholic priest, had a radio show who was opposed to the American Empire. And he wasn't really a Catholic, but Charles Lindbergh was an example of, you know, the American First Committee opposed to American entry into World War One. This is sort of this Midwestern opposition to the Eastern Seaboard elite's drive to war. That's a domestic example, perhaps. But you also talk much about the Catholic state itself as a concept. So here we have this peculiar situation in America, this unique situation in America where there's no established church, and you talk about that this is a unique situation. Now, given the situation, I'm getting feedback. One, two. Okay, now it's okay. given America as a proposition nation, as it was said, as Henry Luce proclaimed in 1947, here we have there's no one religion. There's states at the time it's founded, you had state churches, but nevertheless, America really is a pluralistic society, but it's largely decentralized up until the middle of the 20th century. So you can say, well, maybe that it can work practically because of its political decentralization. But when it becomes an empire after the Second World War, that's when it becomes increasingly problematic and also a destabling and dangerous force on the world scene. But there's other countries that are historically Catholic, like Spain or Italy, and those countries were targeted specifically by the CIA and also the American the Catholic Church, particularly American Catholic Church, after the Second World Franco and such. You cover that. Do you want to explain that, how that went down?
Well, Franco. I think the lessons of Franco are very important. He started a rebellion in Spain in 1936, and he won by 1939. And what he did is he led the nationalist cause against a republic, and the republic was based largely on the principles of liberalism. But the base of his support were the nationalists. There were people who saw Spain as a nation, as a group of people on a bit of soil. And nationalism is always opposed to liberalism. That idea is still extant. It's still very much in the thought of the highest levels of the American society, because nationalism puts up borders. It puts up barriers. And barriers are one thing that make the accumulation and the concentration of wealth very difficult. So Franco was able to defeat the Republican government, but he really didn't, you know, he and his troops were Catholic, but the Catholics had formed political parties in Spain, but they all fell apart, and they just they didn't really help him. But he did it on a national basis. Once he got in there, of course, he protected the church, and he established the church and the Catholic religion as the basis of his policies. Now, I'm sure there were some deviations, but in the big areas, especially economically and as far as the protection of the church and the suppression of erroneous doctrines or religions or other religions, he was very effective. By the time the 1960s and 1970s came around, the priests that were going into Spain were actively working against him and seeking to expand liberalism. And the church did nothing. The church leadership did nothing in response to his appeals to stop the subversion of his regime. Now, he died in 75, and by 1978, there was a new constitution, and you had religious liberty, like in America, which meant the disestablishment of a church, the disestablishment of a religion, and religious freedom, which means you can pick and choose whatever religion you want. So the church was very much, became a fifth column in Spain, and the priests and the leadership of the Catholic Church are pretty much still a fifth column in countries they go to around the world. And there is a very real fear. I think that's part of the fear of the Chinese government of the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church is heavily sympathetic to the Americans. And the Chinese still have an ethnic identity, and it's protected in the form of the Communist Party. But they have a lot of authority in the government and with the party. And the American idea is just the opposite, that government is bad, it's a necessary evil, and we've got to give people rights and freedoms. And that those rights and freedoms include religious liberty and disestablishment of the church and of the state religion. And so when that happens, again, powerful private interests come to run the society. And you have this fractionalization of society. So, yes, the Catholic priests and the Catholic leadership have subverted a lot of Catholic countries like Italy, Spain, and Latin America. All throughout Latin America, the Catholic Church subverted all those societies too.
Mm-hmm. And so, Franco's Spain, where you could make the case that Franco's nationalism protecting the integrity of Spain as a Catholic state might have, in the short term, inhibited wealth production or wealth accumulation because there were restrictions on trade and such. But in the long term, protected Catholic Spain from the eventual ravages of globalism, Freemasonic globalism, which we're seeing now. Because if you look what's happening in Spain now under liberalism, declining birth rates, abortion on demand, aggressive gay rights, gay marriage, and these things. I just read an article just this past year during their traditional Three Kings parade. There was a float celebrating homosexual rights in Spain. And this is a Christmas celebration that they have. And so, if you look at a country like Spain, which is now suffering secular decline economically, demographically, liberalism has not been a boon to Spain in the final analysis. It's actually caused a decay of society. So there's some vindication to Franco's regime, although at the time it was – I'm getting that feedback in. Testing, test. Okay. At the time, the regime was portrayed as – it was dictatorial. It was illiberal.
That's right. It was the, you know, the dictatorial, tyrannical, illiberal, reactionary. And so it was the enemy. And the Americans and the U.S. government had really targeted Franco for a long time. And they came in initially in 1951-52 saying, we want to put military bases there to protect you against the real bad guys, who are the Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
And that started the opening up of Spain. But I think that... you know, you have to ask yourself, well, what's a good society? What's society mm-hmm. for? You know, you have the American or the liberal view, and then you have, you know, the Catholic view of society. Catholic view of society is there. You're supposed to protect and encourage virtue, right?
Mm-hmm.
The American view or the liberal view is you're there to develop the individual. You have two different views of society, and this is what ultimately the whole church and state issue and religious liberty issue boil down to, is which view is okay, which one is approved by the church. And what Murray did, along basically with time and the power of the United States government, what Murray was able to do was to get a lot of Catholic churchmen to say, well, you know, the liberal view of society is equally acceptable, based on the idea that the church has freedom to do what it has to do, and the natural law is all the civil authorities need. Problem with Connell was that he didn't have time, or the American media behind him. The Catholic Church was pretty much in a reactionary mode, and Connell, you know, also said, well, you know, even if America became a Catholic society, we still wouldn't change the First Amendment. So I think that denoted a lack of will in the minds of a lot of people and a lack of seriousness in these own doctrines by a lot of people too. But you have to ask yourself, you know, what is the purpose of society? And ultimately what Murray was selling and what Americanism is about is a political philosophy, and it's a way to order society. It's a political economy. And so the issue of church and state is not just, you know, whether the state is established, whether the church is established, and that's the only religion, and you suppress other religions. It's really about how do you organize your society. And The Catholic Church now is well approved liberalism. I think Murray said that his attempt was to sanctify the world. I think in one of his articles, and I've got that in the book as a poor paraphrase, but to sanctify the world. I think another way to put it is perhaps what Murray was doing was approving that which had never been approved, or seeking approval of that which had never been approved. And you could probably even argue that he was calling good what was evil. As I look at the clock, we're probably going to run past the hour, which is fine if you want to do that. This is a very good discussion. It keeps going, and I like it. It's very good. I hope it's helpful to your listeners.
If you get tired, just tell me. This whenever, but I'll try to keep it to the time it's allowed. Yeah. But this also contradicted Leo the 13th Syllabus of Errors, right, which was laid out in the late 19th century regarding liberalism.
Well, yeah, Blessed Pius the 9th and Leo the 13th. Leo the 13th really reiterated or republished or reconfirmed what Pius the 9th said. And I detail in my book the aspects of the papal encyclicals where in which Leo the 13th basically said you've got to have a state religion. It's got to be Catholicism. And then that was again reemphasized by Pius the 10th and also by Pius the 11th. And you know, it's really, if you look back, it's pretty clear, I think. You can take a look at the words of Christ in the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, "I come not to, you know, replace the law or to do away with the prophets, but to fulfill them." And so what you're talking about there is going back to the Old Testament and looking at what did the prophets do, you know, Hosea and Jeremiah and Isaiah and all those guys. There's book after book of prophet. And what did they do? And they basically called the civil authorities and the church, the state church at the time, to adherence to the law of God. So what Christ was saying is he was saying, hey, you know what? Like, they called you to the law of God back in the Old Testament. Now all societies are being called my law because I'm part of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, with Henry Luce, you phrase it as such. I thought it was a good way to phrase it. Both Henry Luce and FDR sort of declared war on the world with the four freedoms, these things, these concepts. And also in 1947, I guess that was a speech at Prodeo University?
1953. Is when Henry Luce gave his the American Proposition speech, where he laid out the essence of the American Proposition, which was the doctrinal weapon that was really injected into the veins of the Catholic Church. The speech was written largely by Murray. I came across that in a number of archives. But Luce and Murray were fellow travelers. They totally agreed that America is the ideal of social organization, and it should be spread around the world. But what FDR did with his Four Freedoms speech, I detail in my book, is he said, you know, there are four freedoms here by which we're going to reorganize the world. He was made really no bones about it. That was January 6, 1941. And he said every society, you need to have the freedom to worship, the freedom of speech, the freedom from fear, freedom from want. And he was proposing a worldwide political economy on the order of America, with America as the example. And, you know, it's working, and it's going to continue to work. And it has brought a lot of people prosperity and a lot of people happiness, and is enormously resilient.
And it's also caused a lot of misery and war for other people. Because, one, you said here, this is the function here of figures like C.D. Jackson, and Henry Luce had that, you write about Henry Luce's World Economic Plan, and there was a conference held that included banking, industry, labor leaders, intelligence agencies, government, and the plan was to extend the power of American finance, the U.S. dollar, around the world to create this world global economy. Which to me kind of exposes perhaps the cynicism behind this, under the guise of liberty, they're going to create a liberal imperium with them controlling all the machinery of control, finance, banking. You know, this is, we have the World Bank and the IMF, all controlled by a handful of Anglo-American elite, and they're going to make the world conform to their vision. And that is inherently unstable and confrontational.
Well, I think that they came up with globalization. That was what I posited in my book. They came up with the idea of globalization. And I think any time you have any group of people, you know, trying to extend their belief system, if not their also their political control over others around the world or over large areas of territory, you're going to get some pushback, and you've got to get some conflict. That's what you're seeing, I think, in some measure, if not in large measure, around the world now and for a long time now.
Mm-hmm. Because you can manipulate current, you can have currency manipulation, periodic devaluations to open up economies, collapse them, and then a lot of pump and dump, you know, economic manipulation of entire economies, like you had in Asia in the late 90s, or even Russia, you know, in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, when all those Western experts poured into Russia for their advice, and they looted Russia. These things. So yeah, there's a lot of mischief that can be perpetrated with this stuff. It's power. I mean, obviously, you give a small group of people that much power, they're going to abuse it.
What happened? What has made the spread of liberalism around the globe so successful? The more I think about it, has been the collaboration by the Catholic Church, and by that I mean the leadership. They basically serve to advance these ideas and sanction these ideas and say that they are good. I don't know. You kind of watch what the Pope, the current Pope, is doing. You watch what the previous Pope said and did. And I think that you have to come to the conclusion that they want to stay on the winning side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is important because you mentioned the that speech in 53, in November 1953, by Henry Luce. Of course, Henry Luce's wife, Claire Booth Luce, is installed as the ambassador to Italy at that time, in 1953. And Prodea University, which was set up more or less backed by Western intelligence agencies, particularly the CIA, correct?
That's right. That was Father Felix Morleone. Mm-hmm. A Dominican, and he was funded, I think, while Bill Donovan admitted in his biography or his autobiography that he funded Morleone. And one of the things Morleone did was to set up Prodea University, which says, you know, the ideal of social organization is America. And so Prodeo was set up and running by autumn of 1944, and it sought to get Henry Luce and other powerful private individuals to sit on the board of directors and to help fundraise and lend credibility to it. So by November 1953, when Henry Luce gave the American Proposition speech to the 4,000 or so people assembled, his wife was there in Rome as the ambassador to Italy and the de facto ambassador to the Vatican. They didn't have one officially at the time, because that was a matter of some consternation in the United States. But he was there. He had a reason to be there, and he was highly esteemed all over the world because of his success, his material success in building Time and the News magazine. And he was able to deliver this talk right into the heart of the church. Montini, who later became Pope Paul VI, actually was in favor of Prodeo, setting it up, and I came across documentation that showed he gave it his approval. But once he became Pope, he did things that I don't think Henry Luce liked, and I think a lot of the other American hierarchy didn't like either. And I think one of the biggest things he did was to promulgate Inter Mirifica, which came out in December of 1963, which was it's a document, the first document come out of Vatican II that essentially took aim at social media, as we would call it, and said, hey, you guys have got to clean up your act. You got to be truthful, and you know you can't play mind games. I think it was a direct strike back at psychological operations.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, the Catholic leadership in America and in large parts of the world criticized him for that, and Murray and others were publicly opposed Inter Mirifica. So you had this dissent going on, and nobody was doing anything about it. So you saw the crumbling, really, of the hierarchy's ability to control their own people. It became very clear by the end of 1963.
Yeah, and with Inter Mirifica attacks the manipulation by the press of the conference. But then again, there's the catch there is they're not going to report honestly on Inter Mirifica, are they?
they're gonna twist it.
Yeah. So that's the thing, is they're twisting the you might have been keen to this, but then again, it's not going to be reported properly throughout the world, particularly here in the United States.
But the Catholic hierarchy, even to this day, you ask somebody in a Catholic hierarchy what Inter Mirifica is, and you'll probably get a blank stare.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also, Vatican II promulgated Dignitatis Humanae.
Dignitatis Humanae. That's right. That came out. That was the last document. That was December 7th, 1965. It's an important document. It re-established, republished Catholic doctrine. However, that having been said, as you alluded to earlier, the Americanists and their allies, the Americans, had the ability to twist the document. And one of the people who twisted it was Murray, of course, in the Abbott version of the documents from Vatican II. There was a Jesuit by the name of Walter Abbott compiled all the documents from Vatican II. And Murray commented on Dignitatis Humanae, and he was very selective in his notes. And his footnotes about it, and the essence of his footnotes over the first part of the document was that the American system of social organization, the Declaration of Independence and the First Amendment, was the ideal, and the Church had accepted the ideal as theologically correct, the American ideal as theologically correct, which was not the case. Flannery put out a version. He was a Dominican. Austin Flannery put out a version of the documents of Vatican II in 1975. John Cardinal Wright wrote the introduction to it, and he alluded to the fact that there had been some twisting of these documents and their meaning. And it was a very bare-bones explanation of these documents. But Dignitatis Humanae really reinforces Catholic doctrine. It just puts it in a little different form. And in my book, I detail that, how that happened. But go ahead. I'm sorry. You're going to say something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess what it says is basically is because of human dignity, people have a right to be free from coercion, being, coerced to accept, coerced to become Catholic or, but nevertheless, there is no positive right to that error. There's no right to be wrong, more or less. Right has no error, as the saying goes, right? And so it said, yeah, people should be free from coercion. It doesn't mean that there should be no privileges conferred on the church, as the church's job is to guide society spiritually. Is that a good representation of what it said? And then that was misinterpreted as a sort of a positive support by the church for religious freedom or separation of church and state by the Americanist?
Well, I think my take on Dignitatis Humanae was the Americanists certainly said that the church gave up their preeminence in every society, and mm-hmm. that was used in Spain and Italy to disestablish the church, which is not the truth, which is not accurate. What I think Dignitatis Humanae says is that these other religions can have a place, but the Catholic religion and the Catholic faith has got to inform the policies and still be the established church. It doesn't come right out and say that, but it alludes to it in any of a number of different places of the document.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Americanist interpretation has led to such situations, which you write about in your blog. You had it here. Let me see here.
One of the things I just want to throw in while you're looking here is, and this goes to my last comment, or my previous comment, in Dignitas Humanae, Part 2, Chapter 11, Paragraph 1, there's a reference that God has higher rights, that they must be respected. And so, you know, we're living in the, this is written in the 60s. Everybody's talking about human rights, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Well, God has rights, okay? And those have to be respected. Now, you put that with Chapter 2, Paragraph 10, and, you know, Chapter 1, Paragraph, Section 3, Paragraph 3, and you see that the Christian faith will have to, quote, give practical expression to every sphere of their lives, unquote, and they have to follow the divine positive law, quote, in all his activity, end quote. And so the Dignitas Humanae is given an affirmative duty to the faithful to live the faith day to day and to have it form the basis of what they do in public and private life. This was a big dispute that was going on leading up to Dignitatis Humanae. In September of 1960, you had Gustav Weigel, who was a friend of John Murray and a fellow traveler, say, you know, in public and private life of Catholics are two different things. The private life, this is the Mario Cuomo position 24 mm-hmm. years later, and it's the professor Amy Coney Barrett's position in 2017. Public and private are two different things. And the Catholics are supposed to live the faith in their professional or public way. They're supposed to argue and fight for issues and positions that are in accordance with the faith, which is policies are supposed to be based on the Catholic faith. And so this is one thing that right away, you know, the Vatican II Council, Dignitas Humanae, slapped down. But then the other thing was, what is the basis of the public policy? Well, it's supposed to be the divine positive law. And you have in Dignitas Humanae, again, I think it's Chapter 1, Section 3, where the document says the norm of all human endeavor is the divine law. So this big discussion of natural law versus divine positive law came down in the Vatican II Council, Dignitas Humanae, on the side of the divine positive law. That's what you're supposed to do, folks, and you're supposed to live that and make that the policies of your societies. And that's how I believe the document should be read and understood, given the historical context, mm-hmm. which I document in my book. And those were the two big issues. Those were the two big issues of Dignitas Humanae. And not so much, you know, whether you let other churches exist in a society and let them talk or, you know, whatever. Some people have just looked at Part 1 under a microscope, ad infinitum, ad nauseum, and you just lose sight of the meaning of the document because it was written in a time and a place in response to certain issues that were raised by theologians like Connell in 1959, when he wrote to the Vatican, said, you need to deal with this issue of what is the basis. You need to make a clear statement. What is the basis to be a public policy in every society? Because Connell and Murray have been going back and forth for at least a dozen years over natural law versus divine positive law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned Amy Coney Barrett. I think she's the appointee to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and she's a University of Notre Dame law professor who was being, I guess, during her confirmation hearing, was being grilled by Senate Judiciary Committee. One was Senator Dianne Feinstein, and she, the senator, expressed concerns about her dogma. And are you know the, and she says the senator asked if the dogma lives loudly within you, and that's a concern to me, meaning that you check your faith at the door when you become a judge. That's what's her expectation. Now, funny thing is, pretty much only Catholic appointees get that question, if ever, right? I mean, you don't find Jewish appointees getting that question, or you know, no one asks Stephen Breyer or Ruth Bader Ginsburg if you know, does the Talmud affect your jurisprudence? Only Catholics get the question of dogma, but in a sense, Dianne Feinstein is expressing the Americanist position, right? I mean, she's.
Well, I think, of course, all the Catholics got excited by those statements by the senator that you mentioned. And, of course, the bishops totally focused on that. Mm-hmm. And this was a big emotional rallying cry, and all the Catholics were up in arms. And the real issue was what you just alluded to, which is that the senator is absolutely correct on the way America is organized, which is that religion is to be private and law is to be public, and the two shall never meet. Law and dogma, law and religious tenets are two separate things. And the religious tenets, the religious morality code, whatever you want to call it, is doctrine, dogma, is not to inform the law. She is absolutely correct. That is the essence of the American experiment. But the Catholic Church doctrine, as I understand it, presented by Father Connell and others, and as reflected in Dignitas Humanae, is no, the law is supposed to be based on the divine positive law of Jesus Christ, which is the Catholic faith. So this is the issue, but the bishops have just totally pushed that aside. They don't want to deal with that. They want Catholics to do well and move up in society too. So They have basically given all of us the approval to do as well as we can. Now, I will say this, and I don't mean this as a slight on a professor who is now a judge, Barrett. She's eminently qualified. She always was. She is top-notch lawyer. She's litigated in cases. Unlike some recent people who were considered for appointment, she's actually been in a courtroom and litigated cases. You know, she's written. She's taught. She's brilliant. She's a brilliant lawyer. So by all means, she should have the position. I think that should be a very good addition. She's already on the Seventh Circuit Court, so she's going to be a very good addition there.
Now, but this is an important point, because I think we talked about this last time we talked a couple of years ago. It's been a while, but again, this is there is a conflict between the American system, the American ideal, the idea, the American ideology, and the true Catholic faith or doctrine. And we need to...
And Pope Francis says, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Oh, go with America. They're right. They got it right. That's what the Pope said.
USA, USA, USA.
Right. So go ahead and be successful. And you know, Christ himself said, right, if you're a Catholic, or a Christian, you got to read the scriptures and say, well, Christ himself said, you know, what you loose on earth is loosed in heaven, what you bind on earth is bound in heaven. So I guess we're being loosed from the doctrine, so we can do that if you're Catholic or Christian. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, this, I mean, we're getting late in the interview, but this is a question I want to ask you, is this idea of Catholic integralism, as sort of an explanation of how this might work in a society that follows the divine law, divine law of Christ. You saw it somehow, effectuated in Catholic Spain, perhaps Italy, before the 1950s. Obviously, these societies have problems. They have their own political problems, and the state wasn't pure. There's corruption, these things. Of course, if you really examine the American system and the corruption that's in the American system and the sophisticated levels of coercion that goes on in America, and also what it does abroad, I don't know if America itself scores well by its own liberal claims. Yeah, you know, so I mean, it's a bait and switch, isn't it? And the idea of liberalism as individualism, you're free to do everything, but really not, you're everywhere enslaved. Psychological warfare, you're really not free. We have tons of laws and bureaucracies and controls on our own selves. So this is what our liberal society has wrought for us now.
In America, you can still do whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
Within limits. Obviously within limits. You can't commit crimes. I'm not encouraging that. But you can do whatever you want to do. If you want to start a little group of Catholics that are just do Catholic things, you can do that. If you want to write the next great American novel, you can do that. If you want to go out and make a lot of money, you can do that. If you want to go help the poor and work in charity, you can do that. You can run for office. You can do whatever you want to do. This is the beauty and the power and the resiliency of this system. And it's been accepted by the Catholic Church leadership. Now, what a lot of people don't know or they won't accept is that that's how it works, is that you have a lot of liberty. You have a lot of freedom to do what you want to do. And a lot of people, they don't accept that. They don't like that. And so what do you deal with in that case? Well, you're free to go off on your own and do what you want.
Yeah, I think you can speak and say and do things, but only to the extent that what you do doesn't really impact the agenda of the power elite.
You know? No, I think that's right. I think this society is on a trajectory. I think a lot of people suffer under a delusion, okay? And I think this delusion, the genesis of it, can be found in my book. When I talk in the late 1940s and 1950s, I discuss this issue of a number of organizations that Luce was involved in, and they emphasize the essence of America as being based on Christian principles. Well, that was a good way to rope all the churches into supporting America versus this godless heathen Soviet Union, which, by the way, had a constitution that dealt with religious liberty and disestablishment of churches that looked a lot like the American Constitution, frankly. But anyway, so you rope in these people, but you have this idea growing up in the 50s of, you know, America is a godly country and we've got to follow this godly idea that was set forth in the Bible, and this is how we are. That is absolute crap. But what you've got nowadays, and you talk to the people who lived before and during World War II, and my father is one of them. He's in his 90s, and he says nobody talked about religion and America being a godly country. He said that's all new. And this is something that you have a whole group of people, the religious right, that has sprung up and said, oh, this is a godly country. We have to be godly. We have to go back to our roots. And no, it was never meant that way. Don't delude yourself, buddy. But people make a living; they feed their ego, and they get to be somebody by harping on that. They get to be somebody. See, so there's room even for them in America under the tent. But what I'm saying is, let's not be deluded by the nature of this. Let's be honest. Let's look at it honestly, and let's proceed from there.
Because that was in the 1950s is when they add, I believe, the One Nation Under God to the Pledge of Allegiance, and
right,
and also in God We Trust on the currency. And
right, and that was who led that charge? The Catholics did.
Mm-hmm.
Who were the guys who wrote the doctrinal warfare program? The Catholics did.
That was Lily and Grace, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Dr. Lily, a Catholic. Where did he come from? He came from a very wealthy Catholic family in America.
The type of family that you described so well. Yeah, that can do well, get rich, and get a place at the table, so to speak.
Yeah. Exactly. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And Catholicism then becomes something that they do a few minutes every week.
And the proper Catholic position relative to the American ideology is not to have a place at the table. Right? I mean, it's kind of like to be kind of excluded from it all. That's kind of like the Because can you really rise up through the can you really wiggle your way up the grease pole of American politics and retain your genuine Catholicism? I don't know. You know.
Well, you have to please a lot of different interests and please mm-hmm. a lot of people, and you got to have an ego to move up. And this is a good time as any, I guess, to talk about Trump. But
yeah,
but President Trump is an American. You know. And there were a lot of people saying a couple of years ago when he ran for office, oh, he's going to overthrow the oligarchs. You know, I just laugh every time people use those words, you know, the oligarchs. I mean, what, is Themistocles running around here somewhere? I mean, you know, that was antiquity. It's over. he is from the same class of people, okay, that exert real power and influence in mm-hmm. the society. Now, he's somewhat of a demagogue. And he also understands the mentality of the so-called little guy.
Mm-hmm.
So what you've got, and what I have told folks with Donald Trump, he's thoroughly American. He completely believes in liberalism, but he appeals to nationalism, you know, to get votes. So what you got is you got trick and tweet. To the people who voted for him, he gives you the tweets. Okay, so you can go out there and look at that. You know, is that kind of a country? Or and they're all laughing and they love it, but they get nothing. But the real tricks are done for his friends. And the big trick was the tax break, the corporate tax break. That's mm-hmm. the big. And I'm going to tell you, he got another 4 years in office for getting that thing passed, because that is a huge game changer. Because now American corporations and American banks have more cash, and cash is king.
It'll trickle down. Don't worry.
Right. It will. It will trickle.
It will trickle. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's it's funny because if you look at the two reigning or supposedly conflicting ideologies of the 20th century, they kind of grew out of the French Revolution. That would have been collectivism and libertarianism, extreme individualism. And I think I was reading Peter Billington's Fire in the Minds of Men about the revolutionary faith. And he made a point, I'm going to paraphrase it, says both collectivism and individualism are materialist ideologies that deny the spiritual element. And they both lead ultimately to the same end, you know, which is, I guess, I don't know, the gulag, slavery, because it denies that essential element in humanity, which is man's spiritual dimension, the soul. And they're making material, you know, if materialism is your end goal, you're already psychologically enslaved. I mean, that's the problem there. Yeah, it's a shame. So, I seem to have lost you. I can hardly hear your voice.
Okay, how about now?
Getting better. Yeah, I encourage people to go out and of course read the book. You can't cover all of it. It's a 990-page book. We seem to be losing our connection. Let's see. Testing. Are you there? Oh, yeah, I was making the point, I think we started to fade out, is that collectivism and individualism or libertarianism are both sort of make material promises, but they ultimately deny the spiritual, which ultimately leads to the same destination, and it's this accumulation of wealth, that is your end goal. Then you're already sort of spiritually or mentally enslaved.
Well, I think I said a little bit ago, a lot of people don't feel that way. They mm-hmm. feel that they are liberated, and people want money more so than they don't want money and wealth and things, because it makes your life easier and better. And there are studies out there that actually it makes you live longer.
Yes.
The wealthier people actually get better care, mm-hmm. Health care, and they actually live longer lives. The whole idea of living in abject poverty was something that I discuss in my book. And C.D. Jackson noted that the Catholic Church leadership was coming around and saying, you know, material wealth is not such a bad thing. And that's a very important part, I think, of the dynamic in the church. And it's not. I mean, people want to live better. They want to have things. Who wants to go out and live in 10 degree below zero in a hovel? For some spiritual need, you know? So this is the challenge that everyone has, is to live life in accordance, you know, with their beliefs, and to have, that's called integrity. And so what you have a lot of times in the situation of the Catholic Church, at least my conclusion in many ways, has been the church is suffering in a large way from a lack of integrity. It simply has certain principles, doctrines, missions that it was given or that it held for so long, and the leadership doesn't seem to want to follow that anymore. And so that can create problems with people in the church and with any organization, which is perceived to not be living in accordance with its basic doctrines or its basic principles.
It's the eye of the needle, right? The parable that Jesus talked about. How do you go about life and, you know, take care of your needs, earn a living, raise a family in a decent way without getting too focused on that. And that is, it's a balance that we're supposed to follow. And certainly the religious instruction, particularly Catholic instruction, is supposed to guide us in that. But if the Catholic Church is indeed neutered and effectively closed out of the public square of influencing public policy, that mission is made all the more difficult because no longer is it considered a proper role. I mean, for the church to have that influence.
Well, I think you touched on one thing that I'd like to comment on, which is that. The First Amendment, with the disestablishment of the church and the freedom of religion, essentially keeps every religion from having any influence on the culture, any real influence on the culture. And that has become more so with the advent of such technological advances. Mm-hmm. The church just doesn't have control. So you get a lot of laity that do a lot of crazy stuff and become religious fanatics, and the churches can't control their own people because of religious liberty and disestablishment of churches. But you know what the Catholic leadership is essentially saying, and has been saying for a long time, is it's okay to move up in society. It's okay to accumulate material things, and I'm just making that an observation, and I don't think there'd be anybody who would want to say otherwise. I think that a lot of people have misunderstandings of the Catholic religion. They have misunderstandings of the nature of the society in which they live, and they penalize themselves as a result of that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to understand the truth of what you're dealing with and proceed accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess a system that gives you. Yep. Oh, losing your connection again. So I think.
I guess I got to just keep speaking up really loud.
Yeah, now you're really clear. So it's frustrating.
I guess that's what it is. I think I have to speak really loud, and I think that's what helps. I've got a tin can here with a string, and I think the string is getting frayed. Because I don't want to spend too much money and be ostentatious.
That's right.
So I think, you know, that's the world in which we live, and that's the reality of the world. And the church and the churches are followers now. They're not leaders. They have not been leaders in this society ever. I think that they have always been the followers. The civil rights movement was largely something that was begun by people outside of the churches. Mm-hmm. And the churches kind of joined in and went along with it. And that is, that's how it is in this society.
Yeah, and
and it's popular. It's a popular society. People always want to come to America and live here.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's the ideal around the globe. There's no question about that. You know, there's a lot of people saying, "Oh, America's going to collapse." America's not going to collapse. It's going to be here until the second coming. You know, this thing is so resilient and so strong and so desired by people and supported by the Catholic Church leadership that it will be around for a very long time, and it will bring order to the world. And I say that as a matter of observation. People may hear what I'm saying and think I'm saying something else, but I'm simply making an observation and a prognostication based on my study of America, which is a very fascinating study. There's no other society like this on Earth. There never has been. And so it's kind of prompted me to do more research and more writing. And hopefully I'll have another book come out about America, its nature, and its resiliency.
Are you working on a manuscript as you speak?
I've got some initial research done. It's been that way for a while, but I've been kind of busy. So I hope to be able to complete it. There are some archives that I want to look at.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay. Well, that is that's David Wemhoff. He's the author of John Courtney Murray, Time Life and the American Proposition, How the CIA's Doctrinal Warfare Program Changed the Catholic Church. You can also check out his website at it's theamericanproposition.com and get a sampling of what's in the book and also kind of what he writes about, the concerns and issues that are raised in the book. Some articles, I had a chance to take a look at it the past couple of days and read the article, so I strongly recommend that website. And also, of course, I strongly recommend you go out and buy the book. It's a very engaging, very thought-provoking, and well-written book, I might say. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, Tim. I appreciate your endorsement of the book and your kind words. I appreciate the opportunity here to speak on your program. I hope that the information that I provided is helpful. And thank you.
Thank you. And listen, good night. And I'll probably post this next day or so. When I do, I'll send you the link. I'll try to see how it came out with all this choppiness and edit and get it together so people can understand what we said. Some of these parts are rather rough, unfortunately, but that's the risk we take with Skype. So let's thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good night then. Bye bye.
Say everything's okay. Bring me southern kisses from your room. Meet me in the middle of the night. Let me hear you say everything's alright. Let me smell the moon in your perfume. Oh, gods and years will rise and fall, and there's always something more. Lost in talk, I waste my time, and it's all been said before. While further down behind the masquerade, the tears are there. I don't ask for all that much, I just want someone to care. Meet me in the middle of the day, let me hear you say everything's okay. Come on out beneath the shining sun. Meet me in the middle of the night, let me hear you say everything's alright. Sneak on out beneath the stars and run. It's king or queen, and we must go down beyond the chandelier. Where I won't have to speak my mind and you won't have to hear shreds of news and afterthoughts and complicated scenes will weather down behind the light and fade like magazines.